Welcome to the Musculoskeletal Medicine Podcast, delivered by the Faculty of Sport and Exercise Medicine, designed for the multidisciplinary community of clinicians working in musculoskeletal clinics throughout the UK. In this series, I will be interviewing a range of people from a wide variety of specialities and interest groups to bring together real-world advice and top tips to help us in our day-to-day practice. Each episode is designed to comfortably fit into the average time it takes to commute to work, which is apparently around 57 minutes and longer if you live in London, sorry about that, and will be packed with knowledge directly from people at the top of their field. So, whether you're a physiotherapist, a GP, hospital doctor, first contact practitioner, or another clinician working with people living with musculoskeletal health concerns, you've come to the right place. My name is Giles Azan. I'm a GP working in the southeast of England, where I also work as a GP with an extended role in musculoskeletal medicine. So hello and welcome, everybody. Thank you for joining us today. I'm really, really delighted to welcome a previous colleague and friend, Laura Finucane, on today, who's going to be talking with us a little bit about the international framework for red flags that she's worked on with some colleagues. So welcome, Laura. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks very much. Thanks for the invitation. It's great to be here.
Superb. So, why don't we start by, although I'm pretty sure most people know your name, there may be a few who haven't come across you before, Laura. So can you tell us a little bit about your role and perhaps how you got to where you are today?
Yeah, thanks. So I am a physiotherapist by background. I have worked as a physio probably for the last 25 or more years. I have a consultant role, more recently I'm in the clinical director role for Sussex MSK Partnership, and Sussex MSK Partnership is exactly what it is. It's a partnership of a number of organisations that provides MSK services in the Sussex sort of middle corridor. And so my role is very much about supporting staff in their clinical decisions, looking at risk and quality of care, basically. That's what I'm doing currently.
So, Laura, many people might have come across you before in the very popular course you run alongside Chris Mercer and Sue Greenor for the MACP on spinal mask raisers and red flags. But I wonder, obviously, it's an area that you're interested in. How did that evolve? How have you become involved in this area?
Yeah, so it's a really great question. I have, as you said, I've been really fortunate to work with the likes of Sue Greenhalgh and Chris Mercer. I think we were asked many years ago now, it feels like a long time ago, if we would run a course around red flags. And so we said, yeah, well, let's do that. And for me personally, I can think of a very specific case where it kind of sparked my interest in this area, because what I felt was, you know, actually we could do better than we're currently doing in terms of identifying serious pathology. And I think for Sue, myself, and in fact, James Self is also one of the people I've worked with closely. We kind of had this sort of twofold sort of area that we wanted to really explore. And one was about increasing that awareness around serious pathology and think about it as a differential diagnosis. And the second thing was about early identification. So, you know, picking these patients up early in that disease process, because what we knew was that if we could do that, then these patients would do so much better. You know, I mean, it's a no-brainer, isn't it? You know, if they are in the early stages, you know, they'll have better outcomes, they'll tolerate medication better, and sometimes we can make a real difference to their prognosis. So from our perspective, you know, we know that actually it, from sort of a professional perspective, we're in the right place to try and make that difference, essentially.
Because it's, so that's how I got involved, it plays, yeah, on your mind. No, that's brilliant. And I guess it sort of tells you a little bit about the way all of our minds work, doesn't it? As clinicians, I always think that you either fall into the category of being a Tigger or an Eeyore. You know, you're optimistic or you're pessimistic. Yeah. And I guess we probably by nature tend to slip into the more pessimistic view of what's the worst thing that might be going, yeah, So it's, although the incidence of these things might be relatively low, I guess it's clearly relevant because we spend a lot of our time worrying about what might these things be, what might present. And I guess that feeds into sort of clinician behavior around identifying and managing red flags and uncertainty, right?
Yeah, exactly right. And I guess you know, one of the reasons we sort of developed the framework was because there was some anxiety about identifying serious pathology. You know, there were massive concerns. You know, people were worried about, you know, what if I miss serious pathology and the consequence of doing so. And you know, you mentioned they're rare. You know, serious pathology is relatively rare. I mean, I would probably argue they're not as rare as we think they are. You know, but you know, it's balancing that really with, you know, most of the time it will be absolutely fine. So 99% of the time you'll see people with nothing serious, but there are those ones that will happen. And I think it's about, you know, recognizing that and actually being aware that that is a possibility, particularly when, you know, you're expecting a condition to resolve in a certain way and actually it doesn't. You know, we've got to kind of ask ourselves, well, why isn't it not responding in the way I would expect it to? And that should in itself just raise kind of a suspicion that something else might be going on, really.
Yeah. So with that in mind, I guess, from the initial interest of running the course, how did that lead to you setting up the international framework and this very international approach to it? Because it was working with iFont, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And so iFont, for people who don't know who iFont is, it's a bit of a mouthful, but it's the International Federation of Orthopaedic Manipulative Physical Therapist. I can't even say it, and I'm the president, so that's a bit of a worry. But basically, it's the musculoskeletal group, I guess, of World Physiotherapy. It's the kind of expert group for them. And basically, there was a question that went out to the membership about, you know, is there something that you want us to develop in terms of frameworks? The previous framework had been around the cervical artery dysfunction, and actually. Yeah. So going to the membership, they just basically said, yeah, we need something a bit more tangible around red flags. So, you know, can you work that up? And, you know, for me, that was delightful because I thought, oh, yeah, that'd be great to do. Mm-hmm. And so that started our journey. And so what we did was we got a group of individuals that had a particular interest across the world. So people like Aaron Downey, Bill Boisenelt, and a few others, and Chris and Sue, obviously, and we just sort of kind of brainstormed what would that look like. And I have to say, if anyone asked me sort of back in 2016 when we started this, you know, what's that going to look like, I had not got a clue. Actually, it was kind of like, well, we've got this sort of we know certain things. We know that there's you know, that we're dealing with serious pathology. We know that there are common serious pathologies within the spine, and we particularly concentrated on that because of that. You know, that's probably the most likely thing you're going to see. So, and within that, so it's called equina, fracture, spinal infection, and malignancy. And then we sort of looked at, you know, how would we develop that? And we really wanted it to be as pragmatic as possible for clinicians, because, you know, we recognized that there was a lot of confusion in the system about, well, when do I use these red flags? What, you know, what pathology would I use it with? There's no, if you looked at traditionally, the red flags are just a list of things that you and I have to determine, you know, what we're going to do with that. And actually my interpretation might be very different to yours. So that standardization was really, really lacking. And I think around that time, the red flags were being called into question because we weren't able to justify them from a sort of diagnostic accuracy perspective. So, you know, in order to justify those red flags, you want to be able to determine that actually, if that red flag's present, then the pathology is present. And of course, we've not been able to do that. And that's not really surprising. When you look at the low sort of incidence, it's very difficult to do prospective studies, you know, with that in that instance. So spinal infection is a really good example. You know, you're kind of looking at 0.4 cases per 100,000 in a Western society annually. Well, yeah. Good luck with that. You know, you know, to do a prospective study is really hard. So actually, we aren't able to put our, you know, hat on some of these red flags, except for a handful, like the past history of cancer is a really good example where actually there's a fairly good moderate diagnostic accuracy that actually, if it's there, then it's you know, there's an increased probability that it will be present. So,
and that's what I quite like when it reading through the framework, which I did again, reread it, obviously in preparation for this. It would be a bit daft if I didn't, but it's exactly what neatly comes across in each of those pathologies is the strength of the evidence behind them. And I think that's it's about adding that granularity, isn't it? That layers of detail to better inform practice. And it perhaps what surprised me, and I don't know to what extent surprised you, was how often there really is not very, you know, great evidence for it. So exactly as you said, so, you know, that previous history of a cancer that metastasizes to bone is, you know, one example, but there's not many, are there? So certainly in cauda equina was something, you know, when I looked at it again this afternoon, I thought, gosh, none of them really have great level of evidence behind them, do they? Is those symptoms that we think are so kind of, you know, cardinal symptoms and signs that are just, you know, very poor level of evidence.
Yeah, which then makes it really challenging for clinicians, doesn't it? You know, particularly if your brain works in the way that I need some hard evidence, because, you know, this is such a grey area. And actually, you know, from my own experience, what I think is that, you know, you build that sort of that kind of sense about a patient, or, you know, you build up the evidence around what's going on for that individual. And sometimes it's just not clear cut. And sometimes it's just odd things that you know, there isn't much evidence. You know, the patient's telling you, well, things aren't, just don't feel quite right, or they're feeling unusually tired, or, you know, and all of these things could be, you know, you could account for them with different pathologies. And it's just kind of trying to nut out, well, do I think that's relevant or not? You know, and it's that clinical reasoning that's really, really important, I think. You know, it's, you've got to kind of wade your way through, you know, what's going on. Does it really fit with what I'd expect to fit? What's sitting outside of that kind of normal presentation that actually I'm a bit concerned about? And I think one of the strengths of the framework is, you know, is the risk factors, actually. So we when we looked at kind of the systematic reviews for each of those pathologies, we used those systematic reviews to pull out the red flags. And of course, with spinal infection, there wasn't a systematic review, so we had to go and do a systematic review, but we couldn't do a systematic review because there wasn't the evidence. So, you know, you're kind of doing a scoping review, which isn't great on the quality side. But actually, what we found was, with the spinal infection, the overriding part of that was the risk factors that these people were presenting with. And so we went kind of like, it was a bit of a light bulb moment for us, really. So we started to think, okay, well, so actually the framework has three areas. One is the risk factors. Has your patient got some of these risk factors? And then putting those signs and symptoms together. So it's that real sort of story, that in the context of that individual, what is going on for them, and using that data as best as possible.
So that would be one of the key, I guess, take homes, is to sort of the way that evidence presented itself, perhaps in that fairly organic way you described, is to break things down by risk factors, signs and symptoms. I mean, the key kind of learning points for people then is look at the risk factors is a good place to start, right?
Yeah.
And it varies depending on which of those pathologies, as you said, some of those areas have got stronger evidence base than others. I mean, fractures got pretty good evidence base behind it, isn't it?
Absolutely.
But contrasted with cauda equina and the rest, it varies enormously. So what is that? What do you think that take home is then for us as clinicians, is to then think about that within that clinical reasoning process? Is that where that took you?
Yeah, I think it did, really. I think, you know, for me, it's about, you know, you could, I mean, and I think this is why this is, it can be quite challenging. And it's not black and white. It's very grey. It's, you know, you could have a patient that comes with no risk factors, and yet they have got metastatic disease. And we may be the first people that pick that up, but actually they don't have any of those risk factors. So it's not a rule of thumb. And I think that's, you know, for me, it's kind of recognizing that they don't always, you know, we're not talking about putting these people into a recipe or a box or an algorithm, and then something's going to spit out the other end. It's kind of understanding how that pathology might play out over time. So if you have the knowledge of, I know that spinal infection, it's likely that most of these people stay fairly healthy in the prodromal stage, where you don't see the symptoms, and then suddenly they fall off the cliff, and actually it gets progressively worse over time. Whereas if you know that with someone with metastatic disease, malignancy, then we know that actually it waxes and wanes, so it can go up and down, and you can be kind of reassured wrongly that actually things are getting better because they look like they're responding to your treatment because they're in a good phase, and then suddenly that gets worse. And I guess it's about understanding those pathologies, how they might play out, and then sort of applying some really kind of sort of almost safety netting or watchful waiting in those instances where you might be, I'm not entirely sure what's going on here. So, you can afford, in most of these cases, you can afford to wait a little bit of time to see how it can play out.
Okay.
Except corticoquine, which is a very different beast, and metastatic spinal cord compression. Those are the two, you're not going to wait. You're going to get those people to the emergency room as quickly as possible when you're suspicious of that.
So can I be a little bit pedantic then? I just want to kind of just get the key points. So you've just outlined a couple there. My kind of rather simple nature is that I like to kind of tie things into a clear laid out pattern. So forgive me if I'm going through this in a bit of a simpleton's approach, but you mentioned a few things there. So if we looked at corticoquine and we said, okay, so one of the key learning points is that none of the evidence or none of the symptoms or so-called red flags of corticoquine hold a really strong evidence base for them. Yeah. But you talked about the natural history, the progression, and I think there's some more work coming out talking about the stages of corticoquine. Is that right?
I'm not entirely sure.
No, maybe I'm misquoting on that one. But I mean, I wonder where you just described really neatly the sorts of things in the natural to look for. So if we focus on corticoquine initially,
I guess corticoquine is not a great example of that because we know that the corticoquine is quite complex. There's no chronology in the symptoms. We know that somebody could just tip into full-blown loss of bladder and bowel, or they might be they might just have some genital numbness that There isn't a set pattern with corticoquine syndrome, and I think that's part of the difficulty around that particular pathology. It's really difficult.
But that in itself is exactly what you want to know, isn't it? Is that it doesn't set a clear path. The natural history will vary from individual to individual, and the rate of change or absence of any clear steps is useful to know. So that's a really important take home, I guess, and there was the new GERFT pathway. Pathway that's come out to help guide clinicians. I wonder what your thoughts were on that. Has that added more information into this?
I think it has. I think I was part of that pathway, and it was incredibly challenging, as you can imagine. There were about 40 clinicians in the room, and it ranged from GPs right the way through to radiologists and surgeons. And it was challenging to get to an agreement about certain things. It was even challenging to talk about, the definition of back pain. I mean, it's quite challenging, and what everyone's role is in each of the pathway. I think what it does, it does give some clarity. I think, it's helpful to have a national pathway. I think it will be challenging because there are certain parts of it where, there is a requirement for, radiologists to be done quickly, so an MR to be done quickly. But it also removes some of the, things like having to do a rectal examination in primary or community care, which I think is the right decision. That's not a necessary thing to be doing. It doesn't add anything to someone's our suspicion of somebody having corticoquine syndrome. It doesn't make a lot of difference, really. So and I think the other thing that's come out quite strongly with it is it's looking at these patients who where are they on that journey. So you could have somebody who comes to me, you know, I could have somebody who comes to me and they've had, I don't know, 4 weeks of back pain and leg pain, and they've got some let's say, again, some numbness around their genital area, but it's remaining the same. And so actually I'm not going to send them to A&E. What I'm going to do is I'm going to scan them urgently, but I'm also going to safety net them, because going back to what you said previously, Giles, it is that, you know, they could tip over into corticoquina the next day. You know, it's important that people understand, you know, this is the possibility. It's, you know, fairly rare, but you need to be aware of this, and this is what you need to do. So, you know, and then we might have somebody who's coming with less than 2 weeks, and, you know, their symptoms are, you know, looking, you know, again, they look like corticoquina, then I'm going to get them to A&E quickly. And then there's this sort of grey bit that people are getting slightly, I guess, worried about is, well, what happens after 2 weeks? You know, well, it's no different to previously. If you've got someone who comes to you with over 2 weeks of symptoms, and those symptoms are progressively getting worse, then you're going to send them to A&E. So it's the stability, yeah, I guess, of the symptoms that we really got to be mindful of.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I suppose that's what I took from reading that pathway, was trying to introduce something around time, you know, the timeline to it. And I guess that's, you know, that's very helpful, not least to stop A&E being flooded with people with, you know, 4 weeks of urinary problems, possibly triggered by half the drugs we're loading them up on anyway. But that's a whole different thing. But yeah, I mean, the timing I thought was quite useful to get from that. But I imagine immediately you get lots of people taking it very literally, whereas the essence, I guess, is the distinction between, you know, long-standing symptoms, which may fit the pattern of potential corticoquina, but are long-standing and not shifting, versus then that progressive neurological decline. So that's that's sort of the essence you're getting across from it, right?
Completely.
So that, because it's an area that's talked about lots of discussion around it. So if we think then around those other pathologies, so fracture, there's a really strong evidence base around risk factors for fracture, and perhaps more so the risk fractures than in terms of the you know, the objective findings that didn't seem to be terribly reliable. But so I guess there was nothing that particularly surprised you within that, or was there? Was there anything that stood out to you that you learned when you were looking at the evidence around fractures?
No. I mean, I think, as you said, you know, it was fairly, you know, the evidence behind that was great. It was pretty clear, really. So that was less, you know, that was not as difficult as the others, if you like, for us. I think, you know, it was fairly pretty clear about what you need. You know, there's such, you know, there's good evidence around what you need to be looking for, you know, and the consequences of that. And then it's just piecing together those signs and symptoms that someone might come with, you know, and deciding, you know, whether you think someone's got a fracture or not, really. So again, it's that putting those pieces together and deciding what is your level of concern, and then deciding, you know, right, okay, what am I going to do with that then?
Yeah. So those features that are pretty well established, the history of osteoporosis, steroid use, trauma, female sex, age, you know, and so on.
Alcohol, diet, all absolutely. Of that. Yeah.
So I think reasonably well established, but then again, perhaps useful to confirm those features. Mm. If we move on then to the malignancy side of things, I think you've kind of already said it, but just to reiterate that really the only red flag that you found had much solid evidence behind it was the past history of a cancer that metastasizes to bone, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Although, sorry, the other one that jumped out at me was the weight loss. I think that still had a reasonable evidence base, which, and because people always ask what's the amount of weight loss, and I think you had 5 to 10% of body weight over a 3 to 6 month period.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is, I mean, again, that's really useful to actually have that quantified. Otherwise, it becomes this rather nebulous, have you lost weight? Yes. Yeah. How much? A bit, you know, I mean, it can be a little bit indistinct.
Yeah.
And then the infection side of thing, because it's such a rare thing. But again, just bringing out what you said already is this, the picture of it sounds like I really want to just pick up on what you mentioned about that natural history, because we certainly know that the from an investigations perspective, you know, this is often an immunocompromised cohort of patients, aren't they? So yeah. We certainly can't rely on blood tests or even the presence of a fever. So no. just tell me a bit more. You mentioned about that natural history with infection.
Yeah, so I guess you know what you tend to see are, you know, as you say, the risk factors were pretty key, but in terms of how it might play out, it can vary. It can absolutely vary, but often in things like TB or discitis, what you can have is this sort of really sort of prodromal kind of phase where patients are healthy and don't complain of any symptoms, and then after a period of time, they suddenly just they appear and they just progressively get worse over time. So what you can get is, you know, they start complaining of back pain, that becomes leg pain, it becomes neurological dysfunction, and so it's almost like you can see a pattern of things deteriorating over time. But again, even that, you know, can vary. You know, when I think about some of the discitis that I've seen, you know, they've either been really rapid following surgical intervention or something like that. But I've also seen ones that have rumbled along for like years post-surgical intervention. You know, so again, they're not easy to spot. And often what with all of these pathologies, probably bar cortiquina, what you tend to get is that the symptoms that people present with, the size of symptoms are actually late stage. So you're not really seeing what you're getting is your wealth of information from the subjective examination. What they're telling you is really critical to pick these up in the early stages, because it's not until the late stages that you start to see frank signs and symptoms. Yeah. And I think, you know, for me, that is a message, you know, pay attention to what the patient's telling you, because that is much more powerful than the signs and symptoms. You may not have anything, and in a way, I guess cortiquine is similar. You could have a normal sensation testing, you know, but they could still have, you know, cortiquina.
Yeah,
you know, I think this is the difficulty, I guess, is just trying to think, you know, what do I need to hang my hat on here in order to think, actually, oh, I am concerned. I'm concerned enough to do something. And I just wanted to go back to what you talked about malignancy, actually, was what you picked up on was, you know, with malignancy, again, what we're thinking about is for malignancy, we're going to see those pathologies that cancers that might metastases. And there are five of them. And I'm sure people will know what they are, but just in case. So prostate, lung, breast, kidney, and I can't even remember myself.
Thyroid.
Thank you. I should know
that's that. All right. It's the rule of bees.
Yes, it's the rule of bees, yeah. But actually, it doesn't mean that other cancers won't metastasize.
Yeah.
But it also doesn't mean that all of those five are going to metastasize either. Yeah. So this... you know, whilst it has a good diagnostic accuracy, you've got to also take some, you know, understand that not everyone's going to develop it. So if we press the panic button and go, oh my God, they've got a past history cancer, I need to send them for a scan, then we're not really not doing the right thing either. So it's about the context and, you know, how else are they presenting and watching it, how it might evaluate, you know, kind of change over time. So it's that continual evaluation as you go through that journey.
And I really like in the framework the way you describe that, and in each of those areas you highlight that in that you're using this information to inform your clinical reasoning, and you describe that in terms of informing level of concern. And I like the fact you've got it visibly laid out as a little kind of marker of concern from low to high. And yeah, I suppose it's how would you best explain that process? Is there more you can tell us about the way we can put this into practice?
Yeah. So basically, I would say there's kind of a two step, isn't there? So there's establishing that level of concern, and that level of concern is based on your kind of history taking, your risk factors, your you know, your social determinants, all of those things that are going to play into whether you're suspicious or not of that person having some serious pathology. And then what you've got to decide is, how suspicious am I? So, you know, it might be, well, they haven't got any anything that I need to worry about. Well, then you're going to continue just to treat that individual in the normal way. But you might want to reevaluate if things change. So that would be normal practice. You might have someone who comes, let's say, with a past history of cancer, but that's it. There's nothing else. It's not enough to trigger any further intervention or you know, thinking about sending them on for further investigations. But what you'll do is you'll watch and wait and see how that might play out over time whilst you're treating them, and you know, kind of work with the patient to think about, you know, are there things that you want them to look out for? And that might be, you know, what happens to their level of pain, what happens to you know, their nighttime pain, and sort of things that you might be thinking, well, that would raise my suspicion further. So if you've got someone who starts to develop those signs and symptoms, then we're in the scenario where we're okay, I now am really suspicious something's going on here, I'm going to further investigate. And your decision then is around, how fast do I need to do that? Is it something that needs to be done today, or is it something that can, you know, it can wait a few days? And so that's the distinction. But you're then really thinking about, okay, let's investigate them or send them to somebody who can. And then it's really making sure that you've got your pathways in place to be able to allow you to do that. That you know, if you find someone that you're suspicious this is going on, what are you going to do with them? Is it an A&E? Is it back to the GP? Is it, you know, into oncology? So understanding your local pathways and having routes in is really important.
I mean, that pathway thing is critical, isn't it? And I guess we know that's generally managed fairly well in kind of many other sort of cancer referral pathways, yeah, are an example, but it does seem historically that MSK stuff has fallen between gaps at times. So yeah, pathway, yeah, knowledge is key. I want to return or expand on that sense of managing uncertainty and the kind of that process, which I think is really important to recognize that this is not, when we're assessing a patient, it's a fixed point in time. However, that's not the only point in time that we can use. We've got the benefit of time in many cases, like you say, response to treatment, the evolution of symptoms, developing other features. So that principle of holding and managing uncertainty is a really key thing, isn't it? There's huge, yeah, amounts of uncertainty, yeah, yeah, in MSK and in this area. So the way, you know, the approach to give us a bit more confidence in that, I wonder, because I'm not sure if it was out of this work that you did that the called Requina cue card evolved.
Yep.
That was sort of, I guess, that safety netting as a principle. I wonder if you could speak a bit about how that arose.
Yeah, sure. And actually, the called Requina card was there prior to the framework. That was very much driven by Sue. And what she'd done was she got a group of patients who were suffering from called Requina syndrome, and actually these were the things that if they'd known about them, they would have done something about it. So it was very much done in collaboration with patients who had suffered from called Requina syndrome, and it's a great card because it you know, it really does highlight, you know, those things. And you're right, it's a card that we would give to people who we were suspicious might go on to develop, or, you know, we were worried they might develop called Requina syndrome. And that's a safety netting principles behind that is around, you know, telling the patient that they might be at risk of developing a particular pathology. These are the symptoms you might want to look out for, and be clear about those symptoms. And then if they were to develop those symptoms, what would they do as a consequence? So, you know, for someone like called Requina, you know, it's not, don't call me, go straight to A&E, and actually knowing that's the route. So they're really clear about, you know, this is the possibility. These are the things you need to be mindful of and look out for. If that were to occur, this is what you need to do. And in some cases, you know, following that patient up where, you know, you feel that there's perhaps that patient doesn't have the capacity to do that, and to really just sort of hold on to those patients that perhaps need holding, but actually empowering those other patients to take some of that responsibility around their care, but giving them the right information and really checking that they understand that. you know,
that's huge, isn't it? Because this is way more than just dishing out the cards for everybody with a bit of radiculopathy, isn't it? And I think that's a really important point, is that although you could put a tick in a box by sending everybody a cue card, there's actually an increased risk, I guess, that they're gonna go off in the wrong direction and potentially at the very least cause quite a bit of distress to the individual about worrying, my goodness, is this going to happen to me, and so on. So it doesn't remove the need to have those quite timely and measured conversations with people about, and it's this principle which again you get across quite nicely in the framework about the principle of person-centered care, about that shared decision making, you know, involving people and sharing that risk with the patient, which I think is a principle which perhaps we shy away from as clinicians. It's very easy to either not talk about risk very much or try and gloss over it very quickly, whereas actually sharing that principle, you know, to have a sensible discussion, you know, that the likelihood of this is low, but I need to tell you about it. Let's just talk about symptoms, what we need to do about it. So those principles of sharing the risk with the patient, and like you say, empowering them to identify the right course of action. And I just wanted to pick up on the fact, am I right in thinking the cue card now comes in a multitude of languages as well?
Yeah, something like 34 different languages.
Brilliant. And where do people find that, Laura? Where's the best place for them
I mean, I can put that as part of the resources, Giles, but it's on a website actually that's really, if I give you the link then we can point people to that, if that's all right. But yeah, it's definitely there. It's worth having.
And whilst we're on the subject, in terms of signposting people, are there any other resources that you think about with that? I mean, not resources. I mean, there's resources in general related to the framework that, like you say, we'll link to at the end of the podcast. But, you know, if you're having conversations with people, the Quadra Equina cue card stands out as a really kind of quite well-established bit of safety netting. Is there anything else that you include in that category?
For the different pathologies, you know, it's interesting. I don't think we've really developed anything, you know, that good, if you like.
I'm not aware. No, exactly. No.
And I think, you know, we have, there are some resources, you know, I might point them to the Osteoporosis Society for extra reading and things like that. But actually, it's quite challenging to find something that's helpful, I think, for patients necessarily.
I think it's very difficult, I guess, because it's that walking that fine line where, when a lot of it's a grey area, potentially we can actually raise concern and it's not necessarily a constructive thing to do. So perhaps it's more in those cases about that conversation with patients around, look, if things aren't improving the way we'd expect them to, that should be a mark, you know, that should be a trigger to have another conversation. Or if things are deteriorating, you know, so it's that safety netting, that use of follow-up, isn't it? That principle that there's a bit more uncertainty, you might routinely follow them up, or at the very least explain, and I guess clearly document, isn't it? It's that principle of making sure that we've got that written or you know, using Accurix or whatever mode we can.
And I, you know, it is about that sort of therapeutic alliance, isn't it? I think there is this sort of paternalistic view about, well, I'm not going to talk to them about, you know, something, I don't want to worry them. And actually, you know, my experience of this is, you know, it's about asking the patient if they are concerned about anything. And sometimes they do raise, well, I'm worried about cancer, and I'm worried about it because Mrs. Jones next door died, she had back pain and she died, so maybe I've got that. Or it could generally be that actually they've got a past history of cancer and actually they have reasons to be concerned. And I think when we explore those, patients are incredibly grateful, and then they start to understand, you know, their role that they're playing in this, because, you know, it's about the context for them. And I think we do patients a disservice if we don't have that conversation and share that journey with them, really.
Brilliant. No, that I think that's key, isn't it? Is that, you know, these different components and not being afraid to involve the patient. They clearly, you know, this is about drawing out the agenda better. So that's what's going to reduce repeat attendances and unnecessary investigations, if we can identify that from the start. Were there any other key sort of thoughts you had, or anything else that you would wish people to take from the framework?
I think I guess, you know, we've covered quite a lot, actually, which is great. I think I one of the things I put down was, you know, we've got to, you know, and you've touched on this, Giles, is around, you know, avoiding that defensive medicine approach. You know, this is about context. It's, you know, again, it's about doing the right thing for our patients, you know, and not over investigating them because it serves to reassure us, because that's not helpful. What we're doing is not reassuring our patients. You know, we are, you know, what we forget is patients get anxious about having scans, about having blood tests, about all those things, and where, you know, for us it's just like run of the mill, but actually for them it can be quite worrying and unnecessary in some cases. So it's really about being able to justify, if I'm going to do this, why am I going to do this, and what's the evidence? And, you know, we in the framework, I'm not sure we talk about this, but we talk about this sort of feeling, or this gut feeling, or your kind of clinical suspicion. And, you know, people talk about it, well, I just have a feeling about it. But often when you ask them about, you know, the case, and they start to talk about it, there's really clear evidence that there is something not quite right. They just haven't processed it and reflected perhaps on what's going on, but it becomes really obvious that it's not just a gut feeling, it is based on some of those signs and symptoms and the kind of their experience of what's, you know, what they've seen in the past. So it's really important to kind of wrap that context around that individual.
I think trust your spidey sense.
Yes.
That's what somebody referred to it before, and I thought that's a great way of describing it. And like you say, knowing that this is based on those conscious and subconscious clinical reasoning processes that are always going on. Mm. And I think a sound principle, and I think it was sitting in with one of our colleagues, Georgie, when I was sitting in on her consultations, and what she did very well was to talk to the patient about what she's doing as she's doing it, to provide relevance and context. So it was this sense that as you go through the clinical reasoning process, that you're actually talking with the patient about, you know, right, what I'm doing by assessing you and doing this bit of examination, you know, I'm thinking, just I want to check how your nerves are functioning or whatever. And this process of involving the patient in that and rationalizing it, talking it through, I think is sound. So you know, the principles of safety netting, of follow-up, of you know, accurate and apt use of the evidence base to inform our practice, I think is the framework certainly helps push us along. So thank you for all your work on that, and right. that with Chris and Sue and your other colleagues, James and others. So I wonder if we, before we bring it to a close, a question I ask everybody is to if there were three points that you would like somebody listening to this podcast to take from it, three key learning points, what would those three be?
Okay, so I think the first one would be that actually, you know, missing serious pathology is inevitable, which sounds really harsh, but I think it because of the way it evolves and it masquerades as a musculoskeletal condition, it's likely that you will miss it. But if you are thinking about it as a differential diagnosis and it's on your radar, particularly when, you know, when as we talked about, that kind of your diagnosis is not responding in the way that it would do normally, then, you know, it's about really sort of recognizing that and not ignoring it. Because, you know, what we can see is in some cases something has changed or something doesn't quite fit the pattern of that pathology, and it's ignored because it doesn't, you know, it's kind of, it doesn't neatly fit into the box. So when it doesn't fit, then do something about it. You know, ask yourself, why isn't that fitting? That's probably the second point. Mm-hmm. You know, ask about that. You know, this is not an easy area. Don't expect it to, you know, for there to be a recipe. This is very much about your clinical reasoning, is about that communication style that you have. You know, we know that, you know, lots of consultations are not easy. You know, that you're not always going to come up with a perfect diagnosis, and often, you know, some of the things that we have to help us don't often help us, you know, in terms of our pathways and guidelines, they're not always that helpful. So you know, you are going to have to use your clinical reasoning and you know, use those resources or those tools like safety netting and watchful waiting. It's okay to do that. That's absolutely fine. So
is that's the
that's at least three like or maybe
that.
Four.
Good list. I love it. That's at least three, Laura. Thank you. An abundance of riches from a fantastic tour through the framework. Thank you so much. We will be attaching to the podcast links to the framework, to the GERFT pathway and the cue card. So thank you. All that remains is for me to say thank you so much to Laura for all your wisdom and insight, and best of luck with whatever comes next.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.